Welcome to Wisdom Rebellion, where we are figuring out how to improve our health, relationships, and family life with the help of the world's leading experts in how we get there, one challenging conversation at a time.
My guest today is Erica Commissar, a clinical social worker, psychoanalyst, and parent guidance expert who's been in private practice in New York City for over 30 years. A graduate of Georgetown and Columbia Universities and the New York Freudian Society, Mrs. Commissar is a psychological consultant bringing parenting workshops to clinics, schools, corporations, and childcare settings. She is a contributor to the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, and the New York Daily News. She is also a contributing editor to the Institute for Family Studies and appears regularly on Fox and Friends and Fox 5 News. Erica is the author of Being There, Why Prioritizing Motherhood in the First 3 Years Matters, and Chicken Little, The Sky Isn't Falling, Raising Resilient Adolescents in the New Age of Anxiety. Today's conversation covered the consistent devaluation of motherhood in modern times, the importance of nurturing and caregiving, as well as the impact of feminism on children, motherhood, and a family unit. We also discussed why some women struggle with motherhood, the hormonal and instinctual responses that mothers and fathers have towards their babies, the impact of troubled upbringing on the maternal attachment, and why the first 3 years are the key stage in a child's development. We know that the work of mothers is seen as less by the economy, but we delved deeper into the reasons why that is. Why the policymakers are refusing to address a glaring problem of skyrocketing rates of mental health issues in our children. And finally, what the optimal raising of resilient children looks like. Without further ado, I give you Erica Commissar.
Why don't we value mothering anymore?
We don't value mothering in modern times because we value things like self-sufficiency and independence and self-determination, nurturing, caregiving. We don't value these things in the Western world. And I also think that the women's movement of the 60s, although it did a lot of good for women, a lot of great things for women in terms of giving them freedom, it also did a lot of terrible things for children because the messaging should have been, work outside the home is something you should have the right to choose. It should be something that brings meaning to your life and brings money into your home, but it shouldn't replace nurturing your children. And that if you have young children, they need you, but you can do everything in life. You just can't do it all at the same time. That should have been the messaging, the messaging of if you're a mother, maybe you can work part-time and still be there to be with your children, but it basically deprioritize children. I mean, Gloria Steinem never had children. And so she said to the world, children don't matter, essentially. They'll be just fine, But she didn't have children. She wasn't a mother. She didn't have the oxytocin in her body. Maybe she shouldn't have been a mother. Maybe some people shouldn't be mothers. And that's fine too. But if you choose to have children, as Penelope Leach says in her work, many years ago, if you choose to have children, then you need to care for them. And that's not a message we got when the women's rights movement came around.
There was something about the feminist movement that really, maybe not at the beginning, but certainly after a few decades of the feminist movement sort of being active, it really started pushing for a very, very specific woman. That was usually a single woman trying to make it in a corporate career instead of the one that actually wanted to marry, having a career that she wants or she likes or she enjoys doing, and at the same time having family, and actually getting these two completely separate worlds meet.
Yeah, I mean, in our country, there was a TV show called The Mary Tyler Moore Show, and she was a very famous actress in America. And the show was about a single journalist living in Minneapolis, I think, and living her best single life and being, a career woman. And this was in the 70s, I think, 60s, 70s. But when Gloria Steinem went to Mary Tyler Moore and said, will you be the face of my feminism? Even Mary Tyler Moore, who loved being a mother, she said, I can't be the face of your feminism as you want me to be. You know, she said, my show speaks for itself, but I can't be the face of your feminism because you deprioritized being a mother. And that's a very important role. So, you know, you're right. It sort of was, it masculinized women. It's interesting because it I always say that feminism took women from patriarchy to patriarchy. It took women from the patriarchy of being ruled by men to being in institutions where they behave like men, where they didn't allow themselves to be the best female leaders they could be. Because as female leaders, we would never abandon our children. So we would find ways to, we would do workarounds. We would, you know, in other parts of the world, children go with you to work. Children go to your store that you keep. Children go to the farm, you know, but while you're picking potatoes. Children go to the weaving and baking cooperatives that you work in. So women work all over the world outside the home, but they don't leave their children behind. So that's being a wonderful female leader. So what we did is we went into a patriarchy of our own making, you know, where we became the men. Rather than saying we want to be the best female leaders and the best women we can be, which is that we are also emotionally intelligent and don't abandon relationships. Instead, we start competing with men to be men. And that's not really, that doesn't make use of what our best talents are, I would say. Now, does that mean you can't be one of those women? Of course you can. The women's movement gave, feminism gave women the right to choose. I don't have to have children and I can have a deeply meaningful life. And I think that's important too. Not everybody's meant to have children and not everybody should have children. And children are an incredible joy, but they're also an incredible responsibility and a lot of work. And not everybody's suited for that role. But if you're gonna have children, don't have them like accessories in an outfit, like a scarf or a pair of sunglasses. They're the main act. Your job is the accessory when you're raising young children. And even when you're raising adolescents, I mean, if you treat your job as the main outfit and your children as an accessory, your children will not grow up healthy.
I think it's interesting, I think, how we sometimes talk about women wanting to have kids and perhaps not all women should have kids. And undoubtedly, that is true. But I also think that it's really difficult because I was your typical A-type personality, obsessed with my career. And for majority of my life, I was vehemently adamant that I will not have kids. Fair point, I come from a broken family, quite complicated background. And I think a lot of what was driving me particularly was, I'm not doing what my parents did. There is just no way. But then I met someone that was different than other people. And it was like, yeah, not only I definitely want to have kids, but I want to have kids now. And again, even when I was pregnant, I was adamant that I will just go back to work. And my partner even was saying, look, just leave it open that you might not want to. And fair point, he was right. It is on record now. But once our little boy was born, there was no way that I was prepared to go back to a career where I was working 12, 14-hour days because the priorities change. And I could have not predicted that even when I was pregnant. So
You had a transformative moment. Some women have what I call transformative moments, right? You give birth and you look at this child and, you know, and that transformative moment is wonderful. It doesn't happen in all women. Sometimes it happens in reverse. They say, I want children. I want to have a baby. I'm so excited. I can't wait. And then this baby is born and they look at this baby and go, oh my God, I can't do this. I don't want to do this. And they fall into a deep postpartum depression. So you're right. You never know what's going to happen when you give birth.
So what's going on there? Like, because obviously we know Abigail Tucker, I think, wrote the book Mom Genes. So we know that the pregnancy
makes all sorts of very complicated changes within a woman to prepare her really for being a mother. But clearly it doesn't quite work for some women, and some women are very open and set in the fact that they are not going to have kids, and even when they meet their life partner, that doesn't really change for them. What's going on with the women that, for example, that process doesn't quite work? Do we know? Has someone done the research about that?
Well, there's two things I'm going to say. Part of it's hormonal, but just a small part of it. The hormones are a catalyst. When you have a baby, there's a lot of oxytocin running through your body, particularly when you give birth. But I always say that giving birth is sort of a psychotic experience. It's like taking mushrooms or MDMH, it's like a little bit of a psych. It is. And for the father, too, in the old days when the father sat in the waiting room, it wasn't. But, now the father's in the delivery room and, we take it for granted. But this little person, this little alien person is growing inside you and moving, and then out it comes out of your body. And you think, wow, this is quite a thing. And for some women, it's like a life-changing moment where they look at this child and the dependency, the attachment starts right away. For other women, dependency, this level of need of this child on you, doesn't open up happy doors of, doesn't open up a door to the past of a beautiful relationship with your mother or a beautiful relationship with your parents. And, instead it opens up terror, fear, even rage. There's a lot of going back to bottle feeding these days because women say, I don't want to breastfeed. I don't want to use my body as a vessel to feed my baby. Or there's no milk coming in because we know that stress impacts milk production. And so, I think as a culture, You can tell something. I'm going to say it's not totally like a gamble how a woman's going to react. I would say if you were going to look for a precursor of something that would help you to understand how that mother might react to her hormones is how she deals with dependency in her life before that baby. Meaning, I know this sounds strange, but did you love having pets? Because pets are entirely dependent on you. Did you love taking care of your grandmother? Did you love taking care of your spouse? Did you love, cooking and taking care of? The nurturing parts of you exist before you have a baby. It's dependency, isn't it? It's sort of caring for others and dependency. And it's either there or it's been killed over generations. So we say, there's a very famous piece of research by a man named Michael Meany, and he researched mammals, and he said that the mammal mothers the rat mothers who licked and groomed their young passed down generationally the ability in the next generation to lick and groom their young. But if a mother could not lick and groom her young, she did not pass down the ability to lick and groom to the next generation. Now, that's not genetic. That's called the inheritance of acquired characteristics. And so if our own mothers are not affectionate, joyful about mothering, if they're not loving dependency, loving caretaking, loving caregiving, then we don't inherit that. I mean, it's interesting. The other thing the research showed is that the babies who were licked and groomed were more resilient to stress. Because here's the deal. Having a baby is stressful. It's very stressful. It's stressful on your body. It's very hard work. So when mothers run back to work, I almost feel like some of them are running. Some of them have to go back to work. And so we're not talking about those mothers. And those mothers need paid leave. And that's it. And, a lot of those mothers that are forced to go back to work don't want to go back to work. But the ones who choose to go back to work, I would say that they struggle with the fear and the inability to cope with the level of responsibility and hard work. It's actually easier to go back to a desk job of 12 hours a day than it is to be fully responsible for a child, because a child is nonstop. There's no lunch breaks. There's no me time. There's a little bit of me time, but not too much me time. If you live in a multi-generational home, there's some me time. If you have a nanny, there's some me time. Otherwise, there's not much me time. And it's constant. And it's demanding. And so I think mothers who have been licked and groomed, so to speak, are given the resilience to deal with the stress that comes with the responsibility and the dependency of an infant. And those that weren't licked and groomed, it's a little bit more of a crapshoot that maybe you've come from a family where your mother was depressed or alcoholic or borderline personality disorder, and you are a survivor in that shipwreck and you come out loving your baby. It's possible. But for the most part, that licking and grooming research is very important because it's passed down through behaviors.
There is some baggage that new mothers are carrying from the way that they were mothered. Something that you said earlier on about pets, I actually have got a little hypothesis about it that I developed, which was inspired by Chris Williamson. Chris Williamson has got a hypothesis about male seduction hypothesis, that men sedate their proclivity for violence, for example, and aggressive status behavior with porn and video games. I've got sister hypothesis that states that females sedate their nurturing or mothering instinct by extraordinary amount of investments in pets, businesses that they very often say that they are their babies, the business is their baby. It's a very funny term. And quite often activism, there is that part of community, over the top, loving, supportive sort of feel in certain communities online. And it's like it goes against everything that we know about intersexual competition. And I'm starting to think whether it's actually starting to serve another purpose, whether the women that are haven't actually started their own family. They're trying to create the family when there isn't one. Again, that's just a hypothesis. But when you mentioned pets, I was like, interesting that.
But remember that a business, even if it's your own business and you're entrepreneurial, and I'm entrepreneurial because I had to start my own business. My practice is my own business, and I don't work in an institution and never have. And so in my very early days, I worked in a clinic for 4 years, but that I was a very young, young woman. And so what I would say is that a business is something you can close the computer and go to bed and not have to worry about till the next day. You can make choices to take a day off and just, you know, have take an hour off, you know, I mean, and so it's a very different kind of baby. Even a pet is a pet, you know, who you can leave a cat, you shut the door and you go out, and a dog, you know, listen, if you treat your pets, your cats and dogs and birds and bunnies in a very detached way, you're going to end up with very neurotic animals because they also need a lot of attention. But it's a different level of commitment. And I think that a lot of women are breaking down postpartumly because they have babies. And instead of that transformative moment that you had where you look at this baby, I mean, look, I am a psychoanalyst. I've been well analyzed for many, many years because that's part of our training. I had a very loving mother. She wasn't perfect, but she loved babies. And, you know, when I brought my baby home, and I put that baby on our bed, and my husband and I looked at that baby, and we looked at each other, and we said, oh my God, this baby is here to stay. This is our responsibility. This little boy is our responsibility for the rest of our lives. And that moment of, you know, in the hospital, I love my babies, and I, you know, but I bonded. But it wasn't until I looked at that baby on our bed, and I said, oh my God, this baby is ours. This is our baby for the rest of our lives and our responsibility, and how this baby turns out is up to us. And that moment, my oxytocin went through the roof. But there is a little bit of a moment, even in mothers who are deeply connected to nurturing, where there's a recognition. Now, for the mothers who fall into postpartum depression, that moment makes them go south, not north. That moment makes them feel like, oh my God, what did I do? Instead of excitement and joy and rising to the occasion, they fall into a state of despair and a state of, how can I do this? I can't do this. I'm in over my head. Really feeling like they're drowning. And that's how I would define postpartum depression. So the hormones play a very small part in it. It has more to do with how we're raised. You know, we say there's nature and nurture, right? So we say maybe our nature is about 10% of us and our nurture is about 90%. What I mean by nature is there's a couple things that are constitutional. How demanding and aggressive we are to survive. Some babies will just lie there and look at the light, and if nobody feeds them, we'll go to sleep. Other babies will scream their heads off and say, come feed me, I'm hungry. And in truth, I always say to people that it's actually, even though you think you want the passive baby, the baby who is demanding, those are the survivors. But that's constitutional. The other thing that's constitutional is things like risk-taking, impulsivity. Those are constitutional things, right? You know, you have a little boy, you know, later on you can see, you know, maybe he's the kind of little boy who jumps off the bed and jumps off the railing and, you know, is bouncing off the walls. Or you have a little boy who's sitting quietly reading a book in the corner, you know, so you have, that's constitutional, impulsivity. So people don't think about that as constitutional. They say, oh, something's wrong with my child. No, that's actually constitutional. How much risk you're willing to take is sort of constitutional. Funny enough, the people that are less at risk for mental illness are people who take less risks. Isn't that interesting? People who take some risk, but not too much risk, are people that avoid things like drugs, alcohol, anything that's too dangerous. You'd say, you know, you think about who are the people that survive, or the people who take some risks, but not too many risks. The people that are a little fearful. We don't want to disfear. A little bit of fear means caution. So the kids who are like constitutionally impulsive and take risks, those are the kids we have to be there more for, because we have to guide them. We have to bring care and self-care into their lives. We can't do that if we're not there.
So obviously we've got this mothering instinct that perhaps is not as strong on the population level as it used to be. And part of it, you mentioned, is actually down to the way that we were raised, down to the blueprint that we were passed through our families.
Yeah.
But you can't also look outside into the culture, into the way that we've got policies structured, especially you guys in the States, and think that the entire world doesn't seem to be completely antinatalist at this moment in time. So what's happening everywhere? Because it seems to be that the culture and the politics also don't really care much about mothering and perhaps giving the young kids the best start in life. They talk the talk, but there is no walk behind that talk.
No, not in the States. We care more about, you know, look, I'm a capitalist too. I was just visiting a communist country and, you know, I visited Cuba and I saw the impact that strict communism can have. So I'm a capitalist. I am. Having said that, capitalism values making money and economic development more than it values relationships and family values. It just does. And to say otherwise is just false. It just doesn't value relationships. In some social democratic places, they do. They, you know, you have more socialist places. They say relationships matter, children matter. But no, we don't care. We care about the GDP. We care about getting more women into the workforce. We care about the economy. We care about, in America, we care more about our military than we do about our children. We put more money into our military than we do into our children. So yes, they talk the talk, you know, until, I will say, it may not be in my lifetime. You know, I run around and wave my arms and talk about this stuff, but, you know, I'm almost 60 years old this year, and it may not be in my lifetime. But, you know, fertility rates go down. children's mental health goes down, their mental illness goes up. You know, you have ill children, you have fewer children. What is a nation without healthy children to carry it forward? So our fertility rates are way down in the Western world, and the mental health of our children is way down. And our children, half of our children, don't want children. And they're very clear about it. And it isn't just about global warming. It's that we've made having children, from a PR perspective and from a support perspective, into drudgery, into an obligation, into who wants to do that? My parents hated that. Why would I want to do that? You know, in the old days, we wanted to do it because we saw that our grandmothers loved it, and our mothers loved it, and our fathers loved it, and our fathers supported our mothers and our grandmothers. And, you know, it was the most important thing in people's lives. Now it's an accessory. Now it's a scarf or a belt or a pocketbook. And you can have it or not have it. And if you get it, you put it in a closet and you close the door and you don't worry about it. And, you know, kind of like that. It's not really, I hate to say, in the old days. The old days were not such good old days, you know. So let's just put it straight. We, you know, health-wise, and but from the perspective, and you know, women didn't have rights, and so we don't want to go back to the old days. It's not like the good old days. We want to move forward in time and take what we've learned and make things better. And so what we've learned is women need to have careers and choices and all of this. It's very important that women have sort of ambition too, and brains, and we're equal and always, you know. But in doing all of that, we've forgotten what children need. And when we forget what children need, we end up with ill children. And that promotes the idea generationally that those, that doesn't, so we say generational expression. The more generations of ill children we have, the fewer generations of children we will have.
On this podcast, I spoke to a few people about these sort of subjects. I spoke to Stephen J. Shaw about the birth gap. Then I spoke to Katie Faust as well about children's rights and essentially prioritizing men's rights. And what's been really interesting to observe is on YouTube comments, I don't get any negative comments from men whatsoever. The most vile, and there was not many, but there was few really vitriol comments about how dare I talk about women not having children. And it's like, we have to, someone has to talk about
somebody
it.
Somebody like, has nobody, to say it.
Nobody is forcing women to have children.
Yeah.
But we can't sit here knowing that only between 5 to 7% of women actually don't want to have kids. The rest of them will at some point regret their decision not to have kids. And currently, according to Stephen's data, between 35 to 40% of Western women end up childless. That's a massive, massive gap of women that will live for a very long time to regret their choice. And it's very difficult to put into words how desperate the need for a child is once it turns on in your head, especially if you haven't, wanted kids for years and years.
The question is, do you want to have children or do you want to care for children? So I think what turns on is a gene, is a narcissistic gene, is a gene to reproduce, is a gene to, is the selfish gene. There's a book called The Selfish Gene. There's a selfish gene, right, that gets turned on. I'm not sure that's the best gene to listen to in terms of having children. Meaning, I think there's a lot of women, so I know I'm contrary to the pronatal movement in that I don't think every woman should have a child, particularly if she, her own mother was so damaging to her. I think there's many ways to be generative and have a good life and feel, you know, but having a child because you're afraid no one will take care of you, having a child because you want to have something or someone that looks like you passed down, having a child because everyone in society is having a child and it leaves you out of some club that you want to belong to. These are not great reasons to have children. I think the best reasons to have children are because you really feel a dramatic need to care for someone else or something else. And it comes from a generous place. Generativity comes from generosity, not from the need to receive. And I think that is the difference between the selfish gene and the non-selfish gene. I think the mothers, and you're right, you can't always tell who that person is going to be. You might have had terrible trauma and you have a baby and that gene of, you know, but there are some, I am going to say there are some precursors. There are some precursors. And those are, you know, I always say to people, on Christmas Day, do you love seeing the expression on people who you give gifts to, or do you like receiving the gifts? Do you like caring for people more than being cared for? Which gives you more pleasure? And I think there are certain precursors in women. You know, and I think we should tell women how hard it is. I think we should tell women how hard it is so they don't have that epiphany when they give birth and go, oh my God, I'm stuck with this person and now I have to take care of it. And instead of the joy that you felt, there's terrific resentment. From the moment that baby is born, there's conflict. So one thing I say to mothers is go to therapy before you get pregnant. Don't, you know, look at your origins and make sure that your origins, or, you know, I'm a psychoanalyst. I believe that people can heal. I believe that when you go, I've treated patients who said they didn't want children, and then they're in therapy for 5 years, and they heal that part of themselves as a child that was neglected or abused, and they say, I'm ready now. I can do this now. So if there's any doubt about your ability to nurture, to give more than take, go to therapy. Check it out, you know, work on that part of yourself. Then when the baby comes, you can have that epiphany, that joyful moment of, oh my God, this person's with me forever, but I'm so excited to do this. As opposed to, oh my God, what did I do? Right? Because that's a terrible thing. I've seen that moment in women. Yeah.
I don't have that experience. I was very tired, obviously, when he arrived. But initially, it wasn't like I had like this overwhelming sense of love, because it wasn't quite that. It was an awe. I was in awe of him. He was so fascinating to me. It was unbelievable and extremely, extremely protective. Like, to the point where I couldn't bear nip to the toilet when we were in still on the ward and my partner disappeared to the house to sort of walk the dog and all that. And I was like, I need to go to the bathroom, but it means that I need to leave the baby like alone. And I was literally, I mean, the bathroom was on the ward. I was 10 yards away from where I was. But the fact that I would close the door and leave that baby behind that door with some other people in the room, I was freaking out, absolutely freaking out. And it was like, So you think it's irrational, but it does sort of take over, interestingly enough, and the fascination with this little tiny thing and the progress that then he or she then starts to make through life. It's just so fascinating to watch.
There's two hormones that get turned on: oxytocin, which is the sensitive empathic nurturing hormone, and vasopressin, which is the protective aggressive hormone. So women have both. They actually have probably more oxytocin than vasopressin, but the balance can be a little different and you can be very vigilant. Don't touch my baby. That's my baby. You know, it's sort of what fathers feel with great. Fathers have a lot of vasopressin. So when their babies are born, they're like, stay away from my baby. I'm going to follow my, you know, so when mothers say, follow the baby to the nursery and bring the baby back, you don't have to tell the father that. The father's like, that's my baby. No one's going to touch my baby. And so it sounds like you had a good amount of vasopressin and oxytocin. And that's healthy. That's what's our hormones are correlated with behaviors. And if we have those hormones flowing through our bodies, then that connects to nurturing behaviors. And fathers and mothers are different, to be honest. Fathers don't have the same calling to the distress of a baby. They have more of a calling to protect the baby. You know, I got to protect my baby. Mothers have much more oxytocin, which is when the baby cries, they're like, you know, I got to get to my baby. I hear my baby cry. I've got to pick up my baby. Even now, my sister just had her first grandchild. My sister's 80, and she had her first grandchild. And she said, it's like impossible. I hear the baby. Now, she's a psychoanalyst like me, focusing on babies and mothers. But she said, I hear the baby, my grandchild, my granddaughter cry. And I like run down there because I got to pick up the baby. And my daughter-in-law says, you know, I'm okay. You know, I'm okay. It's okay. So it never really stops once it's turned on, you see. But I am going to say it doesn't get turned on in all women. And some of that has to do with trauma.
But then can that be fixed?
It can. Some of it can, some of it can. I always say that the sooner you get to an issue, if you ever had like an injury, like an orthopedic injury, and you develop scar tissue around the injury, and they have to go in and they have to take the meniscus out or the scar tissue, sort of what therapy is. It's sort of looking at the scar tissue. Scar tissue is like our coping mechanisms. It's like our defenses that we formed around an injury to help us to function. And then when it comes to nurturing our children, we have to look at all that scar tissue and kind of clean it out. It's a bad analogy, but yes, you can work on some of that. And I have. I mean, I've had mothers come to me and say, the first year of my baby's life, I didn't attach to this baby. This baby came to my office with an attachment disorder. And I helped the mother over the next 6 months or year to fully attach to that baby because it's not too late. And those babies are still receptive to that attachment. So you can work on these things. Better to get to therapy before you have a baby so you can start to look at that scar tissue. But, you know, if you have a baby and those feelings that you described and that I'm describing don't get turned on, it's not too late. You can go to a therapist who specializes in this, not a psychiatrist. If you're so seriously depressed that you feel you're going to do harm to yourself or to the baby, you need to see a psychiatrist because you need to get on antidepressants right away. But if it's the kind of depression where, and you still need to be in talk therapy, but if it's the kind of depression where you're just not, that those feelings, those transformative feelings that we're talking about don't get turned on, yes, you can go to a therapist and work on that. Because it means that there's a block. So energetic healers would say that our natural instinct is, if we see somebody else's child, our natural instinct is not to pick up that baby and love that baby. But our own children, we have a natural instinct evolutionarily to nurture our own young. If we don't, if that doesn't kick in, then there's a block. And so you need to work on that block. But society tells you, don't work on it. Go to work. Leave the baby with someone else. And this offends me because I think it's giving up on women, and encouraging them to give up on themselves.
We are also doing future cost stacking on mass scale currently. We and our politicians don't want to deal with actually difficult issues. So they postpone it to the next generation, to the next 5-10 years, to the time when they are not already in the office. You know, they've already made their money, looked after their family, so to hell with the rest of the society. But it is really sad to watch because a month or 2 months ago, I read the book, older book by Mary Eberstadt, Home Alone America. That was released 20 years ago, and already she was sounding alarm bells about what the early daycare does to children in terms of their development, their behavior. And 20 years later, obviously you guys in the States, the mothers there have got absolutely no maternity leave whatsoever. In the UK, the situation is a little bit better, but it's going downhill pretty quickly. And a couple of months ago, probably about 3 or 4 months ago, one of our main ministers was proudly announcing that they are now going to sponsor extra 30 hours a week for children from the age of 6 months, maybe, or 3 months. So it's all, and these are conservatives. I'm not sure what exactly they're conserving other than their own wealth, but they are supposed to be looking after families. And instead, what they're doing is just chugging women to go to work, to pay the taxes, so they can inflate the GDP in our country. But it's a Ponzi scheme. And you've got the same, even to the worst extent, because you don't even get that 9 months, which currently in the UK, women can take that. But there are plenty of provisions for women to just, you know, be able to go back to work earlier. And it is encouraged. The culture encourages it. So that's where we are. Where should we be?
You should be where Poland is, or where Hungary is, or where, interestingly, you know, there are many countries who have 2 and 3 years of paid leave. I mean, that's never going to happen in America. So I always have to be realistic. But I fight in America for a year paid leave and then another 2 years of either unpaid leave or partial paid leave or part-time opportunities for women in their companies. You know, the truth is, I don't think that working in institutions is really great for women. I mean, this is a terrible thing to say, but I think women should be entrepreneurs. I think women should be trained from a very young age to be entrepreneurs, you know, because I don't think that institutions, I mean, I guess that's an unrealistic thing to say, because I think institutions are the majority of ways that people work, you know, big companies. But I think that companies, institutions are still based on the male model of, you know, how hard we should work, how much we should make, how much investment we should have in our work. And I think that that women are entrepreneurs at heart. They're multitaskers. They need to have control and flexibility over their work. So, you know, there are ways to work and make money and add to the GDP by giving women entrepreneurial opportunities. And that way they don't have to abandon their children. They can still make a good living. You know, I always say that service fields that provide services, whether it's speech therapy or physical therapy or psychotherapy or any service, you know, coaching or a lot of, you know, even nursing, you know, service fields where you have some control over how hard you work, when you work, so you can coordinate with the other members of your family to care for your child, or, you know, those are the best fields for women. So working in these big male-dominated institutions, male-created institutions, because even if women run them, they still run them like the men ran them. Women can be very productive on much less time. You know, that's just who we are. We're made that way. We're made in a way where we can be very productive in short periods of short bursts of time. And so what I fight for in America is a year of paid leave and another 2 years of flexibility to make your own decisions, basically. In the UK, I go to the UK often and talk to members of parliament, and they always come from the Conservative Party, very few from the more liberal parties, but once in a while I'll get one or two people from the Labour Party. But, you know, people who really care. I mean, there's at least 30 members of the Conservative Party who really care about attachment and really care about children's mental health. And I'm guessing that, you know, the rest maybe don't, because I know the members who come to see me and listen to me when I come. And they're fighting the fight. They're fighting the good fight. So not all of them have a misunderstanding. Just the ones who focus purely on financial issues. You know, I say that if you have a country of mentally ill children, you're not going to have, you know, great citizens going forward. You're not going to have functional members of society and high earning, high tax paying individuals in the future. So if you want to look at it just from a very practical perspective as a government, you need your population to be healthy. So by allowing women or men, whoever's the primary caretaker, to be there in those early years, you're basically putting a foundation in the house. So those children are healthier members of society. So yes, you're sacrificing earning in those years from those women, but you're gaining in the long run a healthier member and more functional member of society who's going to support that society. So it's very short-term thinking. Very short-term. In our country, it's just like very short-term thinking.
Yeah, because the problems that they are creating for the next 10, 15, 20 years are just being magnified. But it is a shame. It is such a shame because I think there is so much that could be done. I had a business that definitely was not home-based as such. But with 8 months notice, I've actually managed to rejig the companies a little bit. We dropped one because that required me to be on the road, which I wasn't prepared to do. But we kept the other one and we just basically changed the way that I worked. And I suppose I was lucky because I do have a business partner and he does the running around and he does the going to the places. I work from home essentially in the evenings. And I still do. So I've managed to do that. But it did take me a couple of years. And I think what you're saying about perhaps starting to try and encourage women down more entrepreneurial routes so they can have that flexibility when it is needed, it would solve a lot of problems. Because many women will still work in the evenings. Maybe not for the first couple of months. The first 2-3 months are brutal, especially with your first one, I think, because you're just sent home with this tiny baby. You've got no idea what you're doing. There is no manual. It's like it is, and the lack of sleep initially takes you a while to kind of get used to it. But after a couple of weeks, you kind of really start to get the hang of it. And there is this routine, which if you've got a good sleeper that will sleep during the day, you've got a couple of hours there. Kids do go to bed at relatively sort of same time once they kind of get their biological sort of clock going and telling the difference between night and day. And then you've got evenings. I mean, that's what I'm still doing now, and my little boy is 2.5. So I sometimes work a couple of hours during the day. My partner also works from home, so we are very lucky in that terms because there's two of us at home. So we juggle childcare between two of us during the day. And then I work in the evenings as soon as the little one goes to sleep. And yeah, I could make more money. I could make plenty more money. But like that, there is no cell in my body that thinks that this is what I should be doing right now.
That's the key. Right now, you'll make plenty of money in your life.
Yeah, but this is the thing. It won't last because at some point, you know, my kid right now thinks that like me and his dad are like the best thing since sliced bread. But that is not going to last forever. At some point, they'll get their own maids and obviously they will go to preschool or some sort of classes at some point. So, you know, that this time that we really have got to spend with them isn't forever. So let's talk about what is the optimal then. Like in an ideal world, how much time we would be spending with our kids and when?
Well, I mean, the first 3 years is that first critical period of brain development. So they're the most fragile. I mean, all you need to do is look at them to know that they're fragile. I mean, we don't look at our babies. You know, we look at them and we project onto them that they're not fragile. But if you really look at them, you'll see just how fragile and dependent they are and how vulnerable they are. So the first 3 years to be there as much as possible. And then interestingly, in adolescence, so from 9 to 25, they're fragile again. They don't need you quite in the same demanding way, but they do need you. And if you're not around when they're around and they come home from school and, you know, they'll go internal, they'll internalize whatever they're feeling. And, you know, sometimes the only thing between an adolescent and mental illness is the ability of their parents to help them to process and metabolize their feelings and experiences that are happening in the rest of their life, as you say, in the environment. And so there's so much going on in our children's environment and adolescence. We need to be there as much as possible when they're in adolescence. You know, that doesn't mean, you know, the same as when you have an infant. You know, you're not sitting on the floor and playing with them all the time. But it does mean being around, being in their sphere. So you know, and so, yeah, the idea of being able to work 6 hours a day and be home when they come home from school and, you know, pick them up at school when they're 14 in your car or walk them home or, you know, make, you know, the old adage of making cookies and snacks when they come home and you have that 45 minutes with them while they're eating to process the day. You know, that sounds so traditional and people go, oh, well, I'm making cookies. I don't, but, you know, but the reality was that gave mothers and whatever fathers the opportunity to process with that child what has happened in that 6 or 7 hours at school. And so we don't do that. We say, oh, they don't need us. They're adolescents. They're off. You know, I can go to work before they go to school and I can be back at 8 o'clock at night now. They don't need me. They don't seem to need me. But they do need you. They can't show it because if they show it, it defies the separation process. But they do need you. They need you on their terms. Being an adolescent is a very narcissistic adventure and they need you on their terms. So when you're there and they need to process, they process with you. If you're not there, they'll shut their door and they'll internalize. They'll go play video games. There'll be no one to process it with. You know, by the time you're 25, you're doing a lot more processing on your own. Your brain is such that you're doing a lot more processing. But until you're 25, you're not really, it's sort of like having half-functioning kidneys. You know, like dialysis is for people whose kidneys aren't functioning. They have to clean out the kidneys, you know. Being under the age of 25, being under the age of 3 is like not having kidneys. The parents are the kidneys. By the time you're an adolescent, it's like having partial functioning kidneys and you still need your parents to serve the function of dialysis. When you're 25, now you have 2 functioning kidneys and they're processing. You've internalized your parents and all they've helped you to process. So now when you come up with problem solving and processing of emotions, you can do more of it on your own because you've internalized all those years of your parents helping you to do it. And people still at 25 need to go to a therapist, need to talk to a friend, but there's more ability to process when you have to process. But in adolescence, they still need you.
Okay, so the optimal situation from 0 to 3 is to have as much, the more is more, like you say in
more
your book.
More is more.
The more is more, yeah, I love that. So simple, but so encompassing at the same time. Up to the age of 3, with the mother ideally, who would be the primary caregiver. What then happens at the age of 3? Because I'm assuming it's not like you suddenly can put them in a daycare for 8 hours a day and they are going to be absolutely happy with that.
No. So think about a weaning process. At the age of 3, we put children in preschool in America. And what that essentially means is at 3, we used to start with a few hours a day, a few days a week. You know, you'd get the morning time or the afternoon time, and that's when you, but what's happened is, again, because of the demand for working families, two person working families, preschools now will take children at the age of 3 from 8:30 until 2:30. And these are children who, you know, That's a lot of time for a three-year-old to be away, and it's shocking, you know, to them. So we want to think of weaning into the idea of separation and weaning into the idea of going to school. School is very stressful for children. Being away from home is very stressful. So you want to think about incrementally getting them used to. So I always recommend at the age of three to put them in school no more than 3 hours a day, 3 days a week, if possible, and definitely no more than 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. None of this six hours, none of that at three. At four, again, think incrementally. Maybe you start to do, you know, 9 to 1:30 or two. You know, that gets them ready to go to kindergarten. It's incremental. This is the idea, the gentle introduction of separation. It helps children to adjust to the idea. By the time they get to kindergarten, they are doing 8:30 to 2 or 2:30. And so now you have, you know, what more looks more like a full day of school. By the time they're in first grade in America, they're doing till 3. You know, this is how it is. So I think just thinking about not shocking your children with these things, thinking about introducing separation in a more gentle way, working towards the goal of children being interdependent, a little more independent and interdependent, but not sort of going from, in Sweden, they go from your home all day with your mom for 14 months, and then you go to daycare for 10 hours. And these kids are going into shock. They're going into shock.
That's a long time to be away from home, even when you're an adult.
Even when you're an adult. I mean, I don't like to be away from home for 10 hours. That's the point. So yes, from 3 to 9, it's Freud called it a kind of more tranquil period of development because, again, you still have to be there, yeah, but not as like you can work, you can, they're in school. Listen, when a child is in school from 8:30 to 3, how many hours do you have?
Oh, God, plenty, really. I mean, plenty. Even by the time you drop them off, come home, from 9 to 2:30, easy, that's 5.5 hours.
That's 6 hours. 6 hours of work a day. You have, so I always say when children go to school, that's their work. That's what Maria Montessori would say. It's their work. So you work when they work. Sort of like they tell you when, that's perfect. If mothers can work when their children work. The idea is when they're born, you know, you always hear the best advice you hear is, nap when they nap, right? Nap when they nap because you're sleep deprived. I would say when they go to school, work when they work and keep that up through adolescence. Work when they work. And when they're home, be home if you can because that's when they need you. They need you when they come home. And, you know, the other thing is when your children are sick, they need you. They're vulnerable. They're fragile. They're dependent again. They've regressed. And so if you have to go to some big corporate job and, you know, your boss says, you know, listen, when my kids are sick, I cancel patients. And my patients know I have children. And I say, I'm sorry, I can't come in today. I have a sick child and I have to be home. Don't take a job where you ever feel that you can't be with your children when they're sick. That's not the job for a mother.
I think the certain amount of then flexibility is required, but what I find as well is, because I've got a couple of friends that do have flexible jobs and their commitment to that company is unwavering because the company did allow them to stay home with kids and it gives them flexibility. So when they have to take from the company, I find them giving back 3-4 times more in terms of the time that they will do after the next day or the next week, and there is certain amount of reciprocity.
Oh yeah, my God, reciprocity. When you're given to, you want to give back. It's true.
I could talk to you for 2 hours. We don't have that. So for people that want to find out more about your work, or you've obviously written 2 books. I've so far read one, which is brilliant. That's Being There. Why Prioritizing Motherhood in the First 3 Years Matters. Did I get the subtitle right?
Yes, you did.
And then the second book is about that second period when the kids are a little bit older. So do you want to tell us about that book?
It's called Chicken Little, The Sky Isn't Falling, Raising Resilient Adolescents in the New Age of Anxiety. It's basically a book about the second critical period of brain development, 9 to 25, and what adolescents need to be mentally healthy and what you can do to give them the best start in life. And if you miss the first critical period of brain development, 0 to 3, in terms of being there enough, you have a second chance in adolescence because a lot of the same vulnerability is happening again. They say it's like deja vu all over again in adolescence. And so that means you have another opportunity, another window to repair things with them, to give them a better start so they can go out into the world as adults with the ability to do things like regulate their emotions and deal with adversity.
And do you still work with patients? How can people find you that are more interested in what you do and how you can help them or their families?
I do work with patients. You can reach me through www.komisar.com. That's my website. And it has all the things I write. And you can buy my books on that website. And you can make appointments with me. And yeah, all on that website.
Erica, thank you so much for your time and for your work. I've already said you've changed the way that I've decided to parent our first one, and I'm sure I'll carry that for the second one because it has been absolutely brilliant. I've loved spending time with him, and it's nice knowing that what I felt I wanted to do was actually, there was some evidence behind it. So thank you for that. I really love your work, and I would highly recommend people check you out. So ladies and gentlemen, Erica Komisar,
thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to Wisdom Rebellion. Come and join the conversation on our YouTube channel and socials. The links are in the show notes. And don't forget to follow, rate, and subscribe to the show so we can all build a wiser world together.